Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? We make getting custom window treatments a minor project with major impact. Choose from premium blinds, shades, and shutters. We even have options for your patio, too. Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Our design experts can help you find the perfect window treatments on your schedule. We'll even send free samples directly to you. Plus, we can handle the measuring and installation for you. Unlimited window treatments installed for just one low cost. And with Blinds.com, you'll always get transparent pricing. No hidden fees. Our free shipping and 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step. And into your home, too. Shop Blinds.com right now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off for a limited time at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Joining us right now, a great football writer for many, many years. He's got a book out now that is a tremendous book. Especially, you know, if you're an old man like me and, you know, you're a football nut job like I am, this is, you got to get this book. It's called Guts and Genius. It's about the three great coaches of the 80s, Bill Parcells, Bill Walsh, and Joe Gibbs. And joining us right now is the author of that book, Bob Glauber. Bob, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me in.
We appreciate it, man.
And I'll tell you
my first
else.
Career studio appearance.
There you go.
Really?
Awesome.
This
yeah,
is it. So
what
I mean,
a
I've been
disappointment
on...
for you.
Wow. It wasn't with Stern.
You imagine that interview?
Oh my God. Oh, boy.
I'll counter Joe with this. As somebody that was born in 83, so my first real memories of football myself in the early 90s, I love this even more because a lot of it's new to me. A lot of it is, look, I know who Bill Walsh is. I know who Joe Gibbs is. I know who Bill Parcells is. But seeing and reading about their beginnings is fascinating. And so from that perspective, if you're 25 years old, if you're 35 years old, it's a great read. And I told you, I've read about 60 to 70% of your book. And of course, when I tell you that, you bring something up, and I didn't read that part, so I feel like a moron. Some story about ducks and Bill Walsh. But can I tell you the number one thing that jumped out at me?
What's that?
There's a lot of facts in this book. And maybe, Joe, you're going to say, oh, yeah, I knew that. Everybody knew that. I don't know if you did.
Go ahead.
That Bill Walsh with the Niners after the 82 season, number one, wants to quit.
Yeah.
Wants to leave. Better than that, he looked into trading up to the number one overall pick to take John Elway, even though he already had Joe Montana. Tell me more about that, because I find that fascinating.
Well, look what he did with Steve Young. I mean, didn't he bring Steve Young in just to push Montana even more?
Well, okay, two things. Let me separate them out, because there's a lot of meat there both of them. But as far as Elway goes, yes, he did look into it. You know, when Walsh was an offensive coordinator in Cincinnati, he had a strong-arm quarterback named Greg Cook, right?
Yep. 1 year, 1968, 69, actually.
And he got hurt. He tore up his shoulder. And Bill Walsh blamed himself for that injury because of the play that he called left him vulnerable. So what happens? They got to get a quarterback named Virgil Carter. Mm. He fills in, the immortal Virgil Carter.
Took him to
Virgil
the playoffs
Carter.
That first year,
yes,
1970.
He did. Yeah. So what he did was, Carter was a weak arm quarterback. He couldn't throw 50 yards. He couldn't throw 40 yards, 30. But he was very accurate and very smart and very shifty. So Walsh came up with this offense in Cincinnati to take advantage of Virgil Carter's strengths, and he manufactured offense. He got the ball moving. Like, with the passing game, it was almost like the running game. It was the exact description of Joe Montana, but just in a, you know, more poorly trained guy. And it worked, and this was offense was ahead of its time. Now, West Coast offense
is
everywhere.
Yeah,
it's the predominant offense in football. And that's where it started.
That was the birth of it right
there. That's the birth
of
it right there. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But Bill Walsh still liked strong-arm quarterbacks. And now, as far as Young goes, he thought Montana was done after 86. Remember, he got hurt against the Giants.
Yeah.
He had back surgery.
Jim Burt.
He thought he was done. Walsh gets traded, and Walsh talked to Bill and said, listen, Bill, you know, I'll come over there, but I want to play. So... He says, no, you'll play. Young says to Walsh,
I want to play. Right, right.
So Walsh says, don't worry about it. You know, you're going to play. I'm worried about Joe. They go out for training camp, and Young is out there, and Montana's out there. Montana's firing rockets, man. Now, he didn't have that strong arm, but he's looking great. Couple of practices in, Walsh and Young have a talk coming off the practice field. Young looks at him and says, Bill, like, Joe can play. You know, he's perfect. He's fine. And Walsh looks at him, and he realizes that that's true. Walsh looks at him and kind of shrugs his shoulders. I don't know what to tell you. Right? So then Young, that means he's got to wait years for this thing. Yeah. Now he Montana was benched in the 87 playoffs.
Right.
That was the start of
the
real controversy.
That's the Vikings.
That's correct. At home.
Yep.
And that's kind of when that controversy started. But those two guys pretty much got along. I didn't realize, you know, until talking to them, how well they did get along. And Walsh Young was telling me that Walsh made sure that Young was the kind of guy who would not cause a problem. And it was very important because he knew that this potential existed. So, and it worked out. He said, Young says, Joe and I never said a cross word to each other ever. We got along great. And we knew that we had to be good locker room guys to make it work.
So then why did he go after Elway? Because that's 4 years earlier.
Well, he was at Stanford before that already, wasn't he?
Yeah, he got Elway to Stanford.
Stanford.
He recruited Elway to Stanford. Rod Dauhauer was his offensive coordinator. And Dauhauer, I talked to Elway. Dauhauer was the guy to talk to Elway about it, and he ended up going there. But Walsh went to the 49ers in the meantime, so he never coached him, but he did bring him there.
Hmm. But what was his plan going to be, though? If they had pulled off trading for the number one overall pick and took John Elway, it's now 1983. What's he doing?
I think he would develop him as the starting quarterback.
So Montana would have been replaced.
Now here's the thing. Here's how that trade goes down. Ernie Accorsi, who was like the most unbelievable football historian you'd ever want to talk to, he remembers it like it's yesterday. He says, Bill calls me. And he says, I'm interested in going up to the number one pick. Now, a lot of teams were, but the 49ers were as well. I'm interested in going up to the number one pick. And, of course, he says, okay, but the only way I do that in your circumstance, because they didn't have a first-round pick that year, or they had a lower first-round pick. And of course, he says, the only way I'll do that is if you trade Montana. I'll go for Montana. And then Walsh says, Ernie, I just can't do that to Joe, because he had already won a championship,
yep.
you know, 2 years earlier.
Yep.
But that 82 season.
But that was a strike year, too.
It was a strike year, and Walsh did not make the playoffs.
Right.
He was so despondent afterward. He called Mike White, who was coaching Illinois at the time. Mike White's best friend, assistant coach for him. And he called him up, and he said, Mike, I want you to coach. Mike White's coaching in the Hula Bowl, right? And he calls him in the like middle of the daytime. Mike says, what do you call me? I want you to coach my team. I can't do this. I can't. I failed. And this is a year after winning the Super Bowl,
and as Joe mentioned,
which is only 3 years into his tenure there.
Right, right.
So Mike White says to him, Bill, listen, I appreciate that, but there's no way I can coach your team. You have to be the guy. The only way this works is if you're the coach. Forget about being the general manager. If you're the coach, it's got to work, all right? And Walsh finally decided to continue coaching. But it was a sign that he was so up and down, and he was just – that was his life. He was a very brilliant guy, but a very insecure guy.
Oh, sure.
He was really insecure. And even, you know, Parcells and Gibbs in the beginning of their careers, same thing. They all thought they were going to be fired. So I found Walsh to be fascinating because I found him to be the most brilliant, you know, intellectual of them all. He was able to kind of use that and become the great football coach that he was. He did it through a number of ways. But he was, like, mentally really up and down. And that Duck story was one reason for that. And it was that raised the hair on the back of my neck when I heard that.
Mm.
You want me to tell you?
I need to know now.
Yeah, can you tell me the Duck story?
Give me the Duck story.
First of all,
what page was it on so I know how I missed it?
I don't know. In the index, it doesn't have Duck. I don't want to laugh about it because it was one of the most intense stories I've ever heard. So his son, Craig, Walsh's son, Craig, is telling me that Bill had a very difficult childhood. His father was in the automobile industry. He repaired cars and he kind of finished cars and did a lot of body work. And he moved the family quite a bit up and down the West Coast. So Bill never really got a chance. He was a lonely kid. Never got a chance to really settle down in one spot. So they're living in Los Angeles, and Bill's about, I don't know, 11 or 12, and his parents had given him a pet duck. So he came home every day from school, tended to the duck in the backyard, and loved the duck. Now, this is his son telling me this because Bill has told him this story. Loved that little duck and was so fond of it and so caring for it. And one day he came home from school and the duck wasn't there. So Bill is looking around, you know, where's the duck? And he goes inside. He asks his mother where the duck is, and she doesn't say anything. And he asks his father, where's the duck? And they don't say anything. He smells dinner.
Mm. Oh, jeez.
It was the duck.
Oh my. Are you serious?
I'm serious.
Wow. It was that bad they had to eat the duck?
No, it wasn't because they were poor. It was because they just took it away from him. It wasn't a poverty thing. It wasn't they needed to eat.
Yeah, you could take away a duck. You don't cook it and eat it, though.
Yeah,
that's extreme.
Now, so Craig is telling me this story, and I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
But he said, listen, you know, that story, you know, he was a young boy at that time, but still, there was something that happened at that moment. It was like concrete formed in his stomach. And he said, in my life, I cannot count on these people. I'm not going to be able to count on these people. Now, he's 11, 12 years old,
sure.
His parents.
There was something that kind of a switch that flipped at that moment, and it was extremely important in his life. And Craig, I remember him talking to him. I probably talked to him 15 times for this book. He was tremendous, right? Just a great resource, was very open and very helpful. And this is maybe in our 10th conversation. And we got a chance to kind of be friendly and, you know, just shoot the breeze about this and that. And he says, oh, you know, there's a story. It hasn't really been out there, and you probably can't use it, but, you know, I'll tell you anyway. And he tells me this story. And as he's telling me this, I'm almost starting to cry, literally.
Yeah, that's pretty rough.
And
not really.
But then I'm also thinking, Craig, are you kidding me? this is a very important story.
Sure. Sure.
You know, this story kind of says what, you know, it really gives a window into what this guy was all about and why he was so up and down. You know, he really was a very lonely child.
Crazy.
You wonder why.
Yeah. Bob Glauber with us, of course, a great football writer, and has this great book, Guts and Genius, about Bill Walsh, Bill Parcells, and Joe Gibbs. You know, the whole Parcells thing. You know, he starts out that first year with the Giants. They go 3-12-1, and they really wanted to bring really wanted to bring in Howard Snellenberger to be the head coach
of that team.
He was going to dump him after that year.
They were ready.
Right.
All of the principals were ready. George Young, the general manager, Tim Mara, the co-owner, and Wellington Mara, the other co-owner, who were not speaking at the time. They were still feuding.
Right.
But they all unanimously agreed. Now, John Mara was telling me how this went down, and John was part of it. They all agreed it was just above, you know, Parcells couldn't handle it. He had lost his parents within a 7-month stretch at that time, and they just felt that he was out of his depth, right? So Schnellenberger, George calls Schnellenberger, and he speaks to his agent, Robert Fraley, who's passed on. He was the golfer's agent. He died in the plane crash.
Yeah, Payne Stewart.
Payne Stewart.
Wasn't he also Bill's agent at one point?
No, that's correct.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Fraley talks to George and talks about Schnellenberger, and Schnellenberger can't get out of his contract, but Fraley has to call Bill and tell him. So he calls Bill Parcells and says, you know, you need to know that they asked about Schnellenberger.
So he's representing both guys.
He's representing both guys.
Right.
So now there's some debate about whether George actually knew this. He insists that he did, but it's a little weird.
Sure.
Uncomfortable. That's where the roots of Bill's distrust of George Young started, right then and there. Because, you know, George took a chance on Bill Parcells. He was a defensive coordinator, popular guy, and he gave him a chance. So the Schnellenberger thing falls through, and they decide, okay, we'll give Bill another chance. Now, as it's happening, so it's 3-12-1, there's 25 guys on injured reserve. It was ridiculous. And Bill had it was a 7-point plan that he wrote down. And a couple days after the season ended, he sits down with Vinny Detrani.
He's the writer for
the record.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he's a confidant of Parcells.
Right.
They were very friendly.
Right.
He knew him as a defensive coach. And Bill says to Vinny, I got this 7-point plan. He shows it to him.
But he wanted it off the record, right?
It was off the record.
Right.
So Vinny says, can I write it? He says, no. I don't want George to see it before I show it to him. So he told Vinny before he told George Young, about the 7-point plan. You know, build a weight room, hire a new strength guy. Get a bigger facility, get an indoor facility. And it was, so he comes back and he's got to be a different guy. He was a nice guy and he was taken advantage of at 3-12-1. So he gets rid of Brian Kelly, Brad Van Pelt, trades Van Pelt. Bill says to me, he's trained Brad Van Pelt. It was like I had traded Sam Huff. I mean, come on, right? Because, you know, Van Pelt was a very popular player.
He was good, too.
Van Pelt was very good.
He was very good.
Right. But he was also a bad influence on Lawrence Taylor. He and Kelly were taking Taylor out to drink.
Oh,
wow. A lot, yes. That was kind of where the, you know, where it started for LT with the Giants. It got away from him. And Bill saw it, and he had to change that culture and that environment.
It was interesting. Because a part of that plan, you mentioned it, was the weight room, and it reminds me of stuff that we've talked about a lot recently, the last few years in both sports, about keeping guys healthy.
Yeah.
You know, I remember Tom Coughlin was talking about how injuries could be a cancer, things like that, and that was the first two things, I think, on that list of seven things on how to keep guys healthy. Did it work? Did those things, it worked out well? Because, and then you mentioned his personality started to change. He started to be more of the rougher Bill Parcells going into year two.
He described it this way. He said, in 83, I was trying to be who I thought I should be.
Mm.
Right? In 84, I said, forget it. A different F word.
Yeah, right.
Forget it.
Right. We understand. We get it.
I got to be Bill Parcells.
Right.
And that's when he said, I'm going to be myself. Because if I'm going to go down, I might as well just be who I am. And who he was an engaging guy and a tough guy. And he talked about that 84 in training camp, the 84 season. He says, you know, I went far with those guys. I might have gone too far sometimes, honestly. Mm. You know, he did the Oklahoma drill just about every day. They call it the pace party, where guys just come, you know, helmets first and crush each other. And he said, I might have gone too far sometimes. But that's what I felt I needed to do. And they did turn it around then. So it was a real transformation for him that he had to do.
And it worked. Look what ended up happening.
Sure it worked.
We got more coming up with Bob Glauber. Hold that thought. We got more with you, more on this book. Another interesting thing about Bill Walsh, how he almost became the head coach of the New York Jets. Maybe I'm exaggerating, it was a possibility. Hey, I'll leave
Joe
it at
Walton.
That.
Come on.
One thing I love it in sports. I even love it in history, the whole what-if stuff. And we're talking to Bob Glauber. Mm. The book is Guts and Genius. So with Bill Walsh, he's obviously devastated he didn't get the opportunity to replace Paul Brown as head coach of the Cincinnati Bengals. And so what I was saying before is that when the Jets hired Lou Holtz, what a great hire.
Oh, my God.
It wasn't that Bill Walsh would have been the head coach of the Jets. The way you worded it is that he was interested in it and kind of sent out feelers, but it didn't sound like the Jets even had him on their radar.
Because Leon had no idea what the hell he was doing. Does that sound familiar?
It's one of those great woulda, shoulda, couldas and what if. Absolutely. But what was happening there, it was part of a trend that Bill Walsh experienced from Paul Brown. Paul Brown basically put out the word around the league, don't hire this guy, right? So Walsh, and I start the book with this, you know, where he is just despondent over being passed over by Paul Brown. He went with his offensive line coach, Bill Tiger Johnson.
Yeah, right.
And he had to get away. He went to Mike White's house. Mike and Marilyn White took him in. He had to get away alone, you know, left his wife and kids home in Cincinnati. Just had to get his act together and figure out what he would do. When he went to work as the Chargers offensive coordinator for that year, that first year. And who'd he have as his quarterback but Dan Fouts? And in talking to Fouts, I didn't realize this at the time, Fouts was scuffling. He had problems the early part of his career. And Fouts told me that had it not been for Bill Walsh, he might have been cut or traded.
Mm.
This is a Hall of Fame quarterback. Right. And he turned it around. Walsh worked on his footwork. He worked on his timing, his vision, everything. All things that Bill Walsh became famous for. End of that year, Walsh tells him, I'm taking the Stanford job. And Fouts is like, you got to be kidding me. And he was mortified. And he played the Raiders, had one of his worst games ever because he was so bummed out that Bill Walsh was leaving him. He landed on his feet, though, because Joe Gibbs came the next year.
Right. Before he went to Washington.
Yeah.
Not a bad replacement.
Kind of, you know, yeah.
I was saying this off the air, and again, we're talking to Bob Glauber, his great book, Guts and Genius, about Walsh, Gibbs, and Parcells in the 80s. You talk about great rivals. The Giant-Niner rivalry in the 80s, and obviously the 1993 championship game, I mean, that was unbelievable because, let's be honest, the Niners beat them the first two times they played them in the playoffs, as you know. You know, they beat them in 81, they beat them in 84. After that, the Giants beat them three times, you know, 85, 86, and then 90. And the Niners never wanted to play the Giants.
Nope.
Let's be honest.
Nope.
And laid down. And in 1988.
Oh, yep.
The Rams, they beat the Rams that night, the Giants would have made the playoffs. They laid down like dogs.
Yep. That's what exactly what Phil Simms said to Peter King.
And it's true.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's true.
Yep. And they did not want to face them because the Giants beat them badly in 85 and 86.
Badly.
And in the 86 game, one of my favorite stories in the whole book is right before the 86 game.
Right. So 49-3.
Right before that one. They had beaten them 17-3 the year before.
Right.
Jerry Rice drops the slant route, could have gone for a touchdown.
That was
the whole
in 86.
Game
that was 86. 86 was when he dropped the slant route and the whole game changed. That's it. I'm telling you.
All right, because Rice was a rookie in 85.
Yeah.
Okay.
Still,
to this day, that burns him.
I'm 100% it was 86.
Okay.
In
all right.
49-3 game.
Okay. So before that 49-3 game,
right.
They'd beaten him 17-3 last year, and Walsh and Parcells are talking on the field. You know how the coaches always get together. And you know Parcells is standing there with his arms folded, chewing gum. You know how he is.
Yeah, right.
Hey. So he goes up to Walsh. He goes, hey. In the previous year's game, the 49ers headsets, as Parcells describes it, they mysteriously stopped working right before the start of the game.
Right.
Mysteriously.
This is the 85, the wild card game.
This is the 85 wild card game.
Right.
And Walsh looks at Parcells. Okay, so they go off, but Parcells keeps it in the back of his mind. They win the game. That's it. They meet again in 86, so on the field. They're talking, and Parcells says to Walsh, hey, I know what you did last year with the headsets. If you do it again, I'm reporting you. I'm going to the league. Don't mess with me. But I use that word mess a lot to substitute for that.
Right, to keep your FCC license.
Yeah.
Right.
So Parcells says, don't do it. I will report you. I'm turning you into the league. So Walsh looks up at him. He smiles, and he winks. He goes, yeah, it's just a little gamesmanship. So what does that tell you? Walsh tried, you know, he sabotaged the headsets because he scripted first series, right?
Right.
He cheated, you know, essentially. And Parcells was really disarmed by Walsh's reaction. First of all, he admitted it. Yeah. I was just talking to him about the other day. He says, yeah, he admitted it. I'm like, all right, he admitted it. Ah, you know, forget it.
Goodell would have suspended him for 2 years.
Right.
He might have been suspended, right? But what that did was that really kind of cemented their relationship. And I think Parcells had this, not an inferiority complex, but, you know, Walsh is called the genius. Everybody, oh, the genius this, genius that. Parcells is a fighter, right? He's a Jersey tough guy, bully. He doesn't like that stuff. And he felt a little intimidated by it. He didn't like it. Jealous. But Bill said to me that moment really kind of put Walsh at a different level with me. Walsh respected me more because he knew that I knew, and he knew that I didn't say anything about it, that I just dealt with it and moved on and won the game anyway.
Right.
And then after they beat him 49-3, it was obvious that
And also, you know, just going back to they knocked Montana out of twice. They did it, 86 and 90 in the championship game, the great three-peat game, one of the great games of all time.
It was tremendous.
Oh,
Leonard Marshall got him from Montana's still not too happy about that. He felt Leonard kind of took a little liberty with that. Yeah, took a little liberty with that tackle.
Mm.
But, that was a tremendous game. I mean, going into that game, Jeff Hostetler against Joe Montana. Yeah, okay. On the road.
Yeah.
Right? On the road, Parcells did something so great late in that week. He shows up at his meeting, and he shows up with a big suitcase, big plaid suitcase. And guys are looking at him. He's up at the front of the room, and he goes in his inimitable way. I don't know about you fellas, but I'm packing for 10 days. Okay, I'm packing for 2 weeks because they had the Super Bowl was the week after.
Yeah, right.
Because of the Iraq War.
I think it was. Yeah.
So the Super Bowl is the week later, and they know they got to go right from San Francisco to Tampa if they win. He says, I don't know about you fellas, but I'm taking a big suitcase. You guys can take your little travel bags for the weekend, fellas, but I'm taking my big one. And he just put the suitcase right there. And the team loved it. They started roaring. Because what is he saying?
Right.
He says,
I think we can win the game.
Right,
exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
I think we got the plan. And they did. And Hostetler was brilliant that whole playoff season. He was just brilliant.
Yeah.
And what a good guy. He was a special player. And I got to know him pretty well back then. Because, you know, it's a different time. He would be somewhere else by that time in his career with free agency.
That's
now he'd
one
be
of
gone.
The biggest differences, yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, the Giants had Jeff Hostetler and Phil Simms on the same team. The 49ers had Steve Young and Joe Montana on the same team. And Elvis Gerback, you know, right. It was crazy.
Well,
the
look
rules,
how, but different world.
Look
different
how
different
quickly
world.
The Patriots had to eventually move on from Jimmy Garoppolo.
Of course.
Otherwise, they'd keep him forever.
In the old days, he would have been their guy for, you know, 6 years until Brady was done.
I want to ask you this question because I when I look at these three coaches, here's what I think. I look at the Giants. The Giants under Parcells were smash mouth football. Let's play defense. Let's smack you in the mouth. We're going to run the ball.
Yep.
There was nothing fancy about the Giants offensively.
Right.
The Niners, it is, you know, high wire, you know, Montana, Jerry Rice, Roger Craig, John Taylor, all these, you know, this high, very good defensive team, but no credit for that. It was the West Coast offense, finesse team all the way. And I look at Gibbs's Redskins as kind of being a combination of the two.
Mm-hmm. Good read.
You
yes,
agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, you know, Gibbs was a great thinker. He was an unbelievable thinker and maybe the best strategist in NFL history. And I say that because when you can win three Super Bowls with three quarterbacks, none of whom are going to the Hall of Fame, that's amazing.
It's pretty good.
You know who the only guy who came close is? It's Parcells. Because he won multiple Super Bowls with different quarterbacks.
Yeah.
Those are the only two guys who have done it.
Yeah,
they different
they
quarterbacks.
Weren't, yeah, and not Hall of Famers.
And not Hall of Famers.
Probably
neither.
Should
Phil's
be in.
Close. You know, Phil's
if Phil
close.
Would have been the quarterback for the second one,
he
would have got in.
He definitely would have gotten
yeah.
in. No
yeah.
doubt. And,
yeah.
he, and he probably knows that.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, Theismann was, you know, closer, but
right,
not,
right.
you know, he had a couple of good, really good years, but not, you know, he's not
how
a Hall of Famer.
Let me ask you this about Doug Williams. How much was Doug Williams, I know they went to the championship game with Tampa in 79 when he lost to the Rams.
Yeah.
But how much was Doug Williams set back by playing for that franchise?
Playing for the Redskins or
no,
playing for the
Bucks?
Bucks?
For the Bucks.
Probably a good degree. But what happened was, you know, because he had played for the Bucks, Gibbs was instrumental in getting him to the Bucks. He was the offensive coordinator for John McKay. And he was the one who scouted Doug Williams. And Williams told me that Gibbs was the only guy who came out to visit with him personally and really meet with him.
Hmm.
He showed up at his class. You know, he had student teaching. He was going to be a teacher. And Gibbs actually showed up and sat in the back of the classroom and just observed Doug Williams.
Right, right.
And he came back. He worked him out. They did the work on the board. And he came back and told John McKay, this guy, he's worth a first-round pick. And that's why they did that. So that turned out, that relationship turned out to be very important to get Williams to Washington because it was Joe. But he was about to be traded. Did you know he was about to be traded before that 87 season? They had a trade worked out.
For Williams?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Williams wanted to be traded. So they worked out a deal.
Who was the quarterback? Jay Schrader at that
Jay
point?
Jay Schrader was
right.
the quarterback. He had
right.
taken over for Theismann
right.
when he got hurt.
Right, right.
So Williams wanted a chance to play. So they work out a deal. Beathard and Gibbs work out a deal with the Raiders. And they play the last preseason game against the Rams. They come back. And Gibbs says to Doug, see me in my office in the morning. So they meet. And Williams kind of had an idea that this was going to happen, that this trade was going to happen. And they sit down, and Williams is smiling, Gibbs is smiling. And Gibbs goes, and this is Williams imitating Gibbs. He goes, Douglas? he's the only person other than my mother who called me Douglas.
Right, right.
Douglas, I changed my mind. I'm not trading you. So Williams looks at him and all of a sudden gets angry.
Sure.
He says, you can't do that. You already agreed. He says, and then Joe got very angry as Williams had ever seen him. He says, don't you ever tell me what I can or can't do. I will do everything in the best interest of this franchise. Mm-hmm. Understand? Yes, he understood. And then they talk, and Williams says, "What? Why? You know, why'd you do this? Why are you?" And Gibbs told him right then, he says, I just have a feeling.
Well.
I just have a gut feeling I'm going to need you at this point. And I think I'm going to need you because I think we can do something really special. And I asked Williams, what did he mean by special? Did he mean Super Bowl? He says, yeah.
That's amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah, like the foresight.
It's amazing.
That is amazing.
So late that season, Schrader's scuffling. They play a game in Minnesota. And Williams is getting dressed after the game, and he doesn't know what's going on. And Gibbs announces to the reporters, Doug Williams is going to be my starting quarterback in the playoffs. And then the reporters go to Doug Williams, what do you think of Gibbs naming you the starter? And he's like, what are you talking about?
right.
He just did.
That's crazy.
And talk about intuition.
Yeah.
And then later in that playoff, the game against the Broncos was one of the great.
They killed him.
Great in-game coaching moves. Jeff Bostic, the center, described it, and it was like he was blown away. I'd never seen anything like it.
The Broncos were actually up 10-0.
They were up 10-0. That's correct.
Yep.
Bostic comes to the sideline after a bad series. Gibbs comes up to him. He says, what's going on? What's happening? Tell me what's happening. Well, they're running a 46 defense, and we haven't seen that before. They'd never run that defense before. So Gibbs stands there a moment, puts his hand in his chin in his hand. He says, okay, all right, here's what we're going to do. All right, and he diagrams a couple things, and they basically go to the counter tray again. They go back to their bread and butter, and Timmy Smith lights up. Williams lights up. It's a record second quarter, and they blow him out. And Bostic, he says, I'm telling you, I've never seen anything like that, ever.
Mm.
And he's probably right.
Bob Glauber is with us. He's got the brand-new book, Guts and Genius, the story of three unlikely coaches who came to dominate the NFL in the 80s. You have an event next week at Foley's. Tell me more about that.
Book signing deal?
Very unique, I think, book signing, along with Gary Myers.
Gary Myers.
Longtime Hall of Fame voter.
I've heard of him.
Can we get Klecko in the Hall of Fame, please?
Yes. Well, he's the Jet guy, so put it in the suggestion. No, he's aware of it. We're aware of it.
Yeah, I mean,
we're aware of it.
Can you imagine if he played for like Pittsburgh? He would have been in the Hall of Fame years ago.
Yeah. Hey, three Pro Bowls at three different positions,
yeah,
man.
He was a great defensive lineman. Yeah.
Now, can I finish my promo?
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I just had to throw that. When you mentioned Hall of Fame, I had to throw Klecko out there. You know, I had to.
So Myers and Hank Gola. Remember Hank Gola?
Absolutely.
From the long-time beat
covered
writer.
The Giants.
Post,
too.
Daily News, covered the Giants.
Yep.
I spent most of my career trying to beat these guys' brains in.
Right.
But we all have books out. Gary's got a book.
About the Garfield High School.
And Hank's got it about the Garfield High School championship team in the 30s.
Yep.
So we're going to Foley's.
Benny Babula.
Yeah, Foley's next Wednesday at 7 o'clock. Right by Empire State Building, and we're going to be moderated by Judy Batista, the great Judy Batista of NFL Network and NFL.com, and we're just going to yak about books and football, and it'll be a lot of fun.
Honest question, of the three books, who will do better? Which book will sell more?
This is the Cowboy book Gary's promoting, right?
Yes.
I know, we're in New York.
Will you outsell Gary?
I don't know. I'll try.
See, I think you've
I rub it in his face? Nah.
No, yes, you will. I don't know. The Cowboys have a huge fan base.
They do.
Yeah,
but
especially here.
Yeah.
But you're tapping into three fan bases.
Yeah.
Maybe even four if, you know, Jet fans and Patriot fans want to get in on Parcells. But really, you're touching three. So I give you the edge. No offense, Gary, if you're listening. I give you the edge. I think you may edge him out.
We'll see. We'll let you know.
I want to know the answer.
We'll take the abacus and count them up.
There you go.
Why did Bill Walsh? I want to go back to that because Bill Walsh didn't get the job replacing Paul Brown. Fine. Okay. Why did Paul Brown, as you mentioned, kind of backstab him and recommend him not getting another job? What was that about?
Part of it was that Walsh, they left on bad terms. You know, Walsh was under contract, but he left. He says, I can't stay here. I'm done. So there was some tension there, and there were some credit issues. You know, Bill Walsh was kind of the brains behind the operation, but Paul Brown was getting the credit for it. So there was part of it that. The other part of it was that, and Dick Vermeil was keying me into this. By the way, an unbelievable story about Dick Vermeil when he had his epiphany about having to leave coaching. I'll get to that in a minute. But Dick Vermeil explained that Paul felt that Bill didn't have the correct temperament, the proper temperament to be a head coach. We talked about that up and down thing.
Right,
and
right.
He was worried about that. And Tiger Johnson was a much more traditional, tough, old school, you know, tough guy. More of an even-keeled guy. And Brown was concerned about that manic kind of personality that Walsh had. Now, Walsh did have that personality. He wanted to quit several times during his career with the 49ers. He was ready to go. He once broke down on the team charter after losing to the Dolphins in his second year. Halfway through the season, he started crying. And the coaches and the general manager, John McVay, had to crowd around him to shield the players from thinking there was something wrong. And Walsh just had this breakdown, and he just said, I can't do that. I just can't do it. This is beyond me. I'm gonna fail.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, somehow, some way, he kind of gathered himself and fought on, and it turned it around. That was his epiphany moment. Mm. And it was fascinating. He's a real fascinating. So Vermeil was the one who kind of keyed me into that. Now, Vermeil had his own issues. Walsh would call him up at midnight, and Vermeil would still be working.
This when he was coaching the Eagles?
He was coaching the Eagles, right? He's calling him up in Veterans Stadium. I was like, I got my coaches in here, but he's got to talk Walsh off the ledge from whatever crisis was going on. Walsh was deeply insecure, and he had to vent, and Vermeil was the guy in a lot of times. So Vermeil, one time late in his career with Philadelphia, he was burning out. And I confirmed with him that his epiphany moment, I said, Dick, I have heard that you kind of came to the realization you had to get out of coaching when you were in the bathroom eating lunch. Is that true?
I'd hope so.
And he goes, yep, it was on the crapper. Yep, it happened.
Wow.
Boy.
How's that?
Well, I mean, like, it's crazy.
You come across these nuggets.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And, yeah. You know, Dick Vermeil is an open book. I love that guy. He's such a great person for football. And, so at the same time that he's burning out, Bill Walsh is just coming in, has all these self-doubts, and he's, you know, kind of unloading on Dick Vermeil to try to get through it. Just fascinating. And all three guys. And Gibbs thought he was going to be fired in his first year. And he said, I felt I was going to be the first coach in history fired before ever winning a game. He was 0-5.
Right.
And Jack Kent Cook would come to me, you know, kind of see in my office.
What, went 8-8 of
they
the last?
They went 8-8.
Right.
They went 8-8, and it was a huge turnaround.
Right.
And Gibbs got a call from, tapped on the shoulder from Cook, can I see you? And, like, he said, oh, this is it. I'm going to get fired. They were summoned, Bobby Beathard and he were summoned to Cook's mansion in suburban Maryland. They said, oh, this is it. We're going to get fired. And, no, what he did was he kind of gave him a vote of confidence. Guys, I think you can do this. I believe in you. Hang in there. So they kind of joked about it on the drive home. So it was some tough stuff early on.
This book has a lot of great stuff. You've touched on maybe like 10% of it. There's a lot more. So if you love football, definitely check it out. Guts and Genius, the story of three unlucky coaches who came to dominate the NFL in the 80s. And we thank you for giving us an hour.
And don't forget, write that Jet book. I told you the name of it.
50 years of lousy football.
Blank.
Right.
I don't think it was
that's
lousy.
Like the plane.
It's similar to what?
How about the plane? Like 15 years of lousy football.
That was the
we've
Giants.
Had enough. Right now, 50 years of lousy football. We've had enough.
Well,
15. Imagine that.
15. Nothing.
I wouldn't use lousy football. You know.
I know.
You know
the
word I
said.
Expletive.
The mess with word.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Exactly.
Similar.
Thank you, Bob. We appreciate it.
Thank you,
Bob. Thank
appreciate
you, Bob.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, a Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.